From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Clyde Edgerton has come alive, whether it's something that happened over the course of his writing career, or when his mother took him as a four-year-old to the local airport to see the planes, or whether he was just born that way is one of the things about Clyde Edgerton we hope to learn today. He's written 10 novels, several of which are now films, including and especially Killer Diller. In 2013, he wrote a book of advice, Papa Daddy's Book for New Fathers, and he's also written a memoir, Solo, My Adventures in the Air. His short stories and essays have turned up in New York Times Magazine, Best American Short Stories, Southern Review, Oxford American, Garden and Gun, among others. He has been a Guggenheim Fellow. He is a member of the Fellowship of Southern Writers, and he is the Thomas S. Keenan III Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. In 2016, he was inducted into the North Carolina Literary Hall of Fame. During the Vietnam War, he served as a forward air controller, flying reconnaissance over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Despite all that, he resists being called doctor unless, well, I'll let him explain that. Clyde Edgerton, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm happy to be here, and I would like to say at the outset that I very much appreciate your show. I don't hear it every day, but when I do hear it, it's always about issues which I think so far that I've heard are really important to this community.
Thank you for that. And I'm hoping that we'll get to some of those issues today from your perspective. So tell us first why I am not permitted to call you Dr. Edgerton.
Gosh, I haven't thought about it much. I think I mentioned to someone, well, I grew up in the country, as you might call it, in the 50s. I was born in 1944 in the 50s in rural North Carolina, out between Durham and Raleigh. And all the people I knew were mostly, back then, farmers. Small farms kind of stayed in the Piedmont of North Carolina, by the way, whereas up in Virginia and South Carolina, you had a lot of plantations because the seaports were a little more active. Because when people left England and heard about Cape Fear, they might have been a little less likely to come here. So they went to Virginia, South Carolina, we had all those plantations. But it was small farms, and I grew up around people with values and agrarian background. And the last thing that anybody would ever be coming out of there would be a doctor. So there was a little bit of, unstated feelings of, to use a popular term now, elitism in that. So I never was comfortable. I just kept going to school because I was lucky to have the GI Bill, and I ended up with a doctorate. So it just always makes me comfortable to be thought of as doctor. Personally, that's the way I feel about it.
And so it's about elitism and something that you work against in a lot of different ways. You are a full-blooded North Carolinian, as you just explained, raised near Durham. When you were growing up, did you know people of other races? What was your interaction with people who were not white?
I did know people of other races, and I've written a book called The Night Train, which is a fictional, it's not a fictional account, it's a fiction, it's a made-up story about made-up characters. But there are some things in my life that I could draw from. when I was about 12, 13, 14, at the country store where I went, African-American people also shopped there, but they lived in sort of across the tracks. And so there were two separate communities. But there was a guy named Larry Lyme Holman who was African-American, and he and I got to be buddies just by seeing each other at this store. And we our relationship was such that we started kidding each other about our basketball teams. He went to Durham. He was bused 6 miles to Durham. And I was right there at the community school. Neighborhood school was excluded him. Not unlike that happens today. But we became buddies. And, again, more of a kind of a kidding thing. I knew in my blood and in my culture and in all of my family that black people were somehow not equal to us. It was never stated. There were never any conferences about it. There was never open violence that I knew about. I don't doubt that it was. I think one of my uncles was in the KKK, but it was never told. I heard that, and a neighbor even more so. So there was this weird living in this fishbowl, not understanding as a child what was going on, and then beginning to become an adolescent, meeting this guy. And he was in my backyard one day. We were shooting basketball. I had a basketball hoop. And my father called me in and asked me to ask him to leave. And I was kind of stunned. Something came home to me in a way that hadn't before that incident. I do not remember what I did or what I said to him or what happened. I do remember, though, that he and I challenged each other to a basketball game. And the basketball...
Was this after your father threw him out?
This was after that. And
so that was not the end of your friendship.
No. We'd see each other and kid each, you know, at the store, mainly where we saw each other. I never went to his house. That was the only time he went to my house. But we decided to have a basketball game. And there was an old gym, a little one-room gym. The grandstand was a bench. And the floor was humped so that if you were dribbling down the sideline, you had to dribble sideways, else the ball would go out. So we gathered one Saturday morning. He got eight of his friends, black friends from wherever, and met us down behind the gym. And I knew how to jimmy the lock. I had five of us, eight of them. We went in the gym and played basketball. And it's that happened in the 50s and 60s. And there's a famous Duke game with Duke and someone else. But so
who
you
won?
Asked me, did I know?
Who
I,
won the game?
I do not remember who won the game.
So that wasn't the important part.
What I do remember is that we had only five and they had eight. And I remember that their extra players were lined up. I remember, I don't know why we were, I don't know who was barefooted. Some of us were barefooted. I can't remember. And so when somebody would get tired on their side, go to the end of the line and the guy in the front of the line would come in and play. So we felt outnumbered a little bit. But
you said as you were growing up that you felt it wasn't articulated in any kind of official way, but you felt that white people were better, that people of color were somehow inferior. You don't mean that emotionally. That's not how you, Clyde, felt as a kid, that you understood that to be the view of the adults around you. Is that it?
I think I understood it to be the view of the adults around me, and I think it came a part of me.
It did.
Just like when if you're in a fundamentalist Christian family or a very liberal Christian family, and you're 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, that value system becomes part of you. So I know by the fact, and it was a pretty extreme in terms of language. The N-word was the only word that was used, just like you would be talking about a biscuit or a table or a chair. That was the only word. I know that there are people in other communities in the white South that you'd get in big trouble if you use the N-word. That was not true in my community and my culture. So that's what I grew up with.
So at what point did you realize that there was something wrong there in that worldview? What sparked the opening to a different view?
Two things. One was when a friend of mine and I did use the N-word. We were counselors at a camp. We were in high school. And the head counselor was in the room. And she challenged us and lectured us. And it struck me that here was somebody willing to talk about a belief about that word that was different from my casual use. Now, when I say casual use, that's not to say that I don't think it's one of the most destructive words in the English language in so many ways because of so many reasons, regardless of how it's used and where. But till then, no one had, I had heard or read no challenge of that word. And then later, when I was a senior in college, I had a conversation long into the night with a black person my age about race, and I had a chance to work with an older woman, and we had long conversations, and that began, and then that helped me understand that it was a ridiculous concept.
To view other people of a different ethnicity or different race as somehow inferior.
Right.
There was a conversation on this show relatively recently with a prominent local philanthropist and attorney talking about his relative who is memorialized as a member of the Confederacy, the last Attorney General of the Confederacy, memorialized in a statue in downtown Wilmington. After that show, someone came into the studio and said to him, "I'm really glad that you stood up for Southerners and talked about how we feel, because this whole national discussion has been directed at creating guilt in Southerners." How would you respond to that? Because you come at this as a Southerner, and you talk about entering the experience of a person empathically. You talk about understanding what the use of the term, you know, the N-word might mean to someone, not thinking about it, the effect on that person. Mm-hmm. How do we enter that conversation together with a willingness to explore that other person's experience without, you know, without the accompanying guilt? Is there a way to do that?
That's a fascinating question, and it turns on a course that I taught starting in 2014. I want to answer the question as directly I can, but just to preface it by saying, at the end of the course, we spent one class, should have been a year, studying questions not unlike you just asked, and we came to two conclusions. One was, it's very complicated, and two, people must talk about it.
And we're going to continue to talk about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. Clyde Edgerton is with us today. We will explore his creative adventures, I promise, as a writer, painter, musician. Right now, we're learning about why racism and efforts to promote diversity have risen to a peak level of importance for him. And he's taking your questions on this live Thursday edition. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Author Clyde Edgerton is here. He's the Thomas S. Keenan III Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He's written 10 novels. He's also written a memoir, a book of advice, short stories, essays. And he's spending more time these days researching American history, specifically the post-Civil War era. He's also taking your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And we do have a couple of emails that we need to get to. But first, just before we went to break, Clyde Edgerton, you were explaining the Crossroads Project, which is something that you hope will be a 100-year project. And you were saying that partly through that project and the study of racism and the racial divide here in America, your students learn two things. One, that it's complicated, and two, we need to keep talking about it.
Right, and maybe keep reading about it. One of the things about that literature can do, fiction or essays, is help you see from another person's point of view. And certainly if you have people who are women or from other countries or other ethnic groups, and you know them and you talk to them, you understand to see from their perspective. And it's very difficult for me to understand how standing beside a child or an adult who is African-American and who is an American and who has every right that I do, and they're equal in every way under the law, to stand and look at a statue that's a consequence of giving glory, regardless of what your family did or what you did. I think if the Civil War, given my family, I would have been fighting for the Confederacy. Even in high school, I was arguing about keeping the Confederate flag at the state. But after a certain point, I think you realize that it would be a horrible thing to look at a symbol of something that represented the ownership of you in a totalitarian, horrible way, so that you could be split from your children, so that you could be murdered with no consequence to the murderer. To see that, the horror of that, and realize that many of the statutes came around in the 1900s when people were saying, how can we kind of get back the old days, the glory of it? And I have Confederate stories that a consequence of what happened in war that have to do with my grandmother that I appreciate. But I didn't grow up hearing anything. I didn't know the difference between Lee or Grant or any of that much. We didn't study the Civil War. But now that I have studied the Civil War, and I've found out that in the 50s and 60s, 1800s, there were people who believed that all people should be free, and they were willing to die for it. And that happens to coincide with what our Constitution sort of indicates. And there were people who were willing to die to say, no, in the South, it's not going to work that way. And there were people who were in between those two areas saying, you know, it's okay to have slavery in the South, but not anyplace else. And the number of abolitionists, the extreme people who said there shouldn't be any slavery throughout the South is kind of interesting. It was always an argument. It was never settled that a Southerner was for slavery or for states' rights. And as far as states' rights concerned, if we say the war is for states' rights, the question becomes rights to do what? In the case of 1861, it was the rights to own people and be able to do whatever you wanted to do. So it is a mixed bag. There is I'm proud of my grandmother who poured boiling water over a Yankee soldier because he stole meat from her smokehouse, and she saw who he was. And when he was sitting in the yard, she took a pot of boiling water and poured it over his head and said, I hope you burn in the belly of hell. That's the quote. I can tell that story and be proud of my grandmother for standing up something, but I cannot in good conscience, given what I understand about where we're supposed to be, embrace the fact of glorifying something that was so wrong.
As part of your process, you are in the process now of writing an 11th novel called The Funeral Militia. And part of that process has involved studying the pre-Civil War era, Civil War, and then Reconstruction. And you talk about different sparks during each period. And then you talk about, and I think author Timothy Tyson, who wrote Blood Done Signed My Name, refers to some of these things as pendulum swings. Can you just talk a little bit about the differences in those views and what you've discovered in your research?
Well, I must say that a friend of mine, John Sullivan, is studying the issue close to home in the late 1800s in Wilmington. And what has happened with the digital age is that we can go back now and read newspapers that we couldn't before. So it's fascinating the original history that's happening, even among local middle school students, specifically from Williston and Friends School, who together last spring discovered some newspapers from that era, and discover the power and prestige of the black middle class in Wilmington in the 1870s and 80s. You know, right after this, I knew so little of most of this, and it's fascinating from a historical point of view about what was true that we don't know now that has influenced how we are and how we think and how we organize things and how we set up structures. And why we do that, that's unconscious or that's conscious. And that whole period from 1850-60, the 1850s on through Reconstruction. So you had that, you know, Reconstruction, it was actually believed that there was equality in this nation, perhaps, or believed by some people that we're over the hump. Flash forward to, for example, in Wilmington, 1898, some people don't even know what happened. People listen to this show. A lot of people do. And the more you learn about it, the more you realize what happened in the early 1900s and when I was a child. And there was complete separation and segregation by law between blacks and whites in schools, for example. So to look at the big picture really is fascinating. And in East Tennessee is where my novel's placed, and there were a bunch of abolitionists in East Tennessee. And one out of four people, roughly, I think this is right, were slaves. In West Tennessee, four out of five people there were slaves. And so it's just complicated and fascinating, but people are afraid to talk about it for kind of obvious reasons.
Well, help me on that front.
Well, for example, let's take the massacre that happened here in 1898. People call it a race riot, which makes it sound like a bunch of black people running around the street and a bunch of white people running around the street. That's not what happened. It was a massacre. And you might call it a race riot. So that happened.
Or a coup d'etat.
Yeah, only one of that. So that happened, and I've already forgotten the question.
So tell us what people are afraid to talk about. What do you run across in 2017 that people won't talk about?
White people don't want to talk about that, and black people don't want to talk about it in a lot of ways, especially each other. I mean, this is a painful, awful thing. But in 1998, there was a commission here in Wilmington, a wonderful book written and great leadership that led to a promise to have this taught in the schools. But I think the trick is this. I think if we're going to teach it, and I think some teachers in Wilmington are now working on this, rather than talk about all the bad things that happened and who did what to whom and who should feel shamed and who should feel guilty, rather than getting into all that, say, let's find our heroes, regardless of the ethnicity. Let's find our people who stood up for the right thing, who were white, who were black, during that whole area. And let's build a curriculum around that and study that and find out, let it lead to other people in North Carolina during those times who were heroes, people in the South who were heroes. There's a book called Speak Now Against the Day. And that book, very thick, 7 years of research written by a friend of mine, is about the civil rights movement in the South from 1932 to 1954. People in my class in 2014 from outside the South would talk about the fact that 11 of 14 were from outside the South, talking about how when they were growing up, they heard about racism and that it was in the South. And they're in the Northeast or Northwest. They heard it was in the South. And that was the last thing you needed to say about it. And then when they got here, in many cases, people weren't talking about it for all kinds of interesting reasons. Some of it has to do with shame. Some of it has to do with guilt. Some of it has to do with your own prejudice, which all of us live with, I hope. If we don't prejudge something in the world, or a person comes in with a knife and a gun and says, I'm going to hold you up, you got to prejudge it, you're in trouble. So I'm not speaking, I'm just saying this from a human perspective. It's fascinating and interesting, and students could learn about it through studying heroes, and people stood up for principles that we all agree with, like equality, like equal rights.
Who's the friend of yours who wrote the book? What's the name of the
Oh, his name is John Edgerton. Coincidence, E-G-E-R-T-O-N. We spell it different. We used to kid that we were cousins. But before I taught the book, it's so thick, I knew I couldn't teach the whole book. I asked him what pages. And if you go to the website Crossroads, on my website, ClydeEdgerton.com, you can find the pages to read and you can order that book. And I'm not suggesting people go there, and we're changing it. I mean, Crossroads is kind of acting there. I'm getting off the subject. I'll be quiet and let you ask the question.
That's okay. My guest today is UNCW creative writing professor and best-selling author Clyde Edgerton. You're listening to Coastline. You can ask your own question during this live Thursday discussion by either calling us today at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. I want to get you to talk about how you've observed racism in subtle ways. You say that people practice it, and it sounds like you think that people practice, which is a funny term for, you might say perpetrate, but people practice racism unwittingly in these subtle ways. What do those subtle ways look like? How do they express?
Well, I will say right now that I had no idea what you were going to ask me on this question. I don't want it to seem set up, but it comes to mind that something that happened that wasn't so subtle, but it is subtle in some ways, it demonstrates racism. By the way, by law, when racism happens, when racial discrimination happens, the whole business of racism and the word race is loaded in interesting ways. It's really a concept. It's like saying witchcraft back when, everybody believed there were witches and killed a lot of people because they believed there were witches. And it turns out if you take a biological scientific approach, you'll find out that they aren't. And so that same argument can be made in a very reasonable way about race. On the other hand, the way we use language depends on how we think. I mean, as a consequence of how we think. Let me try to answer your question. One subtle way that's not so subtle is if you have a if you're in a school with a roughly half black and half white, and you have a very you have a program that, that a lot of people want to have, you can exclude certain groups by not allowing parents to go in a community because of, quote, safety issues.
This is a not-so-veiled description of what happened at Forest Hills Elementary, which is part of the new Hanover County Public School System with the Spanish Immersion Program.
Exactly. I wasn't planning to name names or talk about that, but that's exactly what happened. Some parents were not allowed or told you shouldn't go into a neighborhood because of safety issues to advertise this program, which people can get into in March of 2015.
So you're talking about parents being told to not go into high minority neighborhoods.
Well, to whatever wherever they are because of safety issues, quote, to advertise a program that was the Spanish immersion would be great. So that happened. And then the enrollment program started, advertised to open in March 2015. In February 2015, it was full of 40 students, not one black student, in a school, neighborhood school, that was half black and half white. How did that happen? It's very complicated, but in my view, it ended up working against one race. And it was discriminatory. And when the principal was asked, what was the enrollment policy? Was it written down somewhere? The answer was no. And then this was volunteered to me. Some black parents don't want their children to take Spanish immersion because of Spanish gangs in Wilmington, which was a disastrous speculation, as far as I know and as far as people tell me there are no Spanish gangs. But this worked not only to dissuade that population in Wilmington to be told about this program, that the enrollment was to start in March 2015, but to actually go ahead and fill it up before then. And there are records about that. And I didn't know about the records until later on, but I did know that this community had been missed, and it was very disturbing to me. And as an advocate and as a parent, I did everything I could to ask questions and say, I want to work with you to solve this problem. And I was stymied. And I couldn't get answers.
You saw this as a problem of communication not happening in a fair and equitable way for the entire student body.
Initially, I saw it that way.
A lack of opportunity for children of color.
Yes, exactly. That's what happened, and it was very clear to me, and it was clear to at least one employee who complained about it. But her complaint was never allowed to be said formally and acted on. This particular employee, and of course, I don't want to get into all these kind of he said, she said kinds of things, but.
And I do have to say that WHQR hasn't corroborated any of this, and we don't have someone from New Hanover County Public Schools with us today. And so this is Clyde Edgerton's version
exactly.
of this event.
You do have on record some facts. Of officials from the state saying that the principal's moves were that particular program was controlled by, this is quote, controlled by and at the discretion of the school principal. I brought that note in because that's not true in spirit. It's not true because the principal under oath, at least part of the evidence is under oath, swore that first come, first serve, which was the enrollment policy, was approved by senior staff when we first came up with the idea. Now, that's a fact, and there are communications that I have, emails that I have that demonstrated that it was known what was going on. And my letters warning about it were in plenty of time for changes to be made that were not made.
Where does this, and the phone bank is filling up, so we need to get to some calls, but where does this stand now? What's the way forward?
Well, it's very complicated, and the way forward, I've complicated it unwittingly, although I don't feel bad about it. I'm proud of what I'm doing and what I'm seeing and what I've said, and but what I have to do is get my facts. I have many notes mini records ordered in such a way as I can let people know about this who want to know about it. I mean, some people aren't interested, and some people are very much interested. And I want to say what I know, and I want to be fair about it. And I've tried to do that thus far.
We have an email from Stephen Arante. He says, my wife Sandy and I have enjoyed reading aloud to each other a number of your novels, Clyde Edgerton. His question is, do you have a feeling about how many of your lovingly portrayed residents of, and I hope I'm pronouncing this properly, Lister, North Carolina, would have voted for Donald Trump?
I think probably, that's a great question. I think about this all the time when I'm thinking about my characters and my fiction. Most of them would have. And as characters and people, I think most of them probably would have. And I've gone through being with those people whom I love and who are my relatives and who are dear people. And so I'm in a funny place in terms of Trump people and non-Trump people.
Is that an advantageous place, considering?
It's a great place to be as a novelist.
And considering how polarized our culture has become in, you know, on both the local level and
it's a little worrisome to when you're going to a family reunion. It's a little worrisome. But I think if all of us had the values that some of the Trump people I know have and some of the non-Trump people have, which is we can talk to each other, we can laugh together, we can listen, we can make decisions, we can change our mind, then we'd be a little better off.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Best-selling author and UNCW professor Clyde Edgerton is with us today. After this break, you'll have one more segment to call in with your questions. We're going to talk to Mitchell and John when we come back. The number during this live Thursday show is 910-343-1138. You can also email your question to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're learning today about why Clyde Edgerton cares so deeply about diversity and the subtle, pervasive, and perhaps unwitting practice of racism in the current culture. This Thomas S. Keenan III, Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, is working on his 11th novel called The Funeral Militia. And he's taking your questions on this Thursday. There are two ways to get your question in during this live Thursday edition. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. We're going to talk to Mitchell in a second, but first I want to get to David's email that says, Clyde and Rachel, I know both of you pretty well, and I grew up in a South not all that dissimilar from the one Clyde talks about. I find the discussion happening today about race, that whites tend to talk about attitudes and mentalities, negative, of course, that they feel used to exist. When I hear blacks discuss the same mentalities and attitudes, they're talking about something that is very much still around and continuously oppressive. How do you think that all of us, despite our racial background, can bridge this gap? Thanks, David Howell.
That's a fascinating question. It is all around us.
This is not something of the past.
Oh, no, not at all. All you have to do is talk to people. I mean, it depends on who you talk to. You can certainly have a group of friends who are so narrow that you don't know what's going on in the world, but it's blatant and horrible racism in the world. And you just read a little bit. But I think one of the question is, what do we do? I don't know what we do, but I do think reading. And I think, for example, James Baldwin is an author who I've come to appreciate so much because he talks about how difficult it is to hate and love at the same time. And some of the things that – there's a wonderful paragraph. I wish I knew it. I wish I could say it that he wrote about. And he lived such a difficult life, but he maintained a, quote, sunny outlook about other people in a way. It's so easy to hate people who hate you and to generalize. If we didn't generalize as human beings, we couldn't get along either. We have to generalize about things, but it gets overdone when a white person or a black person does something to us or about us and we generalize to the whole group. It's kind of human, but it's so unfair, and it happens systematically in organizations without people recognizing it. And I must say, in fairness to the school system, the program that we're talking about, regardless of the bad things that happened to the people who were overlooked, which I think is where the crime happened, if it did happen. Regardless of that, the whole place was moved. The program was moved to another place, Gregory, which now it's more fair. And I've been out of the loop on that. But I think they made the right move there. But to cover up and what happened was really bad. So to answer your question, which is a difficult one, like I say, it's complicated. But talking about it, you can find out and you can admit how you were or how you are now and why. And people can hear that.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Clyde Edgerton, UNCW creative writing professor and best-selling author. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Mitchell from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. First, I'd like to thank Mr. Edgerton for just his boldness, especially speaking on the topic of race, especially here in Wilmington. I am a 60-year-old African-American man who was raised in Eastern North Carolina, moved away, came back, saw some of the travesties of racism, from the Klans to burning crosses to churches being bombed. And one of the things that I've always noticed is that, and not to make an indictment on all white people, but the white church has propagated and pushed this racist agenda for years and years, and I still see it going on even today.
And, Mitchell, specifically, how do you see the church contributing to that? Clyde also has an answer, but let me hear from you, and then we'll go to Clyde.
Well, I myself, personally, I've been a part of five different white congregations, and my family has always been a little small, minute chocolate in amongst that congregation. But things like the church burning crosses, and people who were supposedly Christians burning crosses are...
You're talking about activities of the Klan being connected to churches? Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes, as I was growing up as a kid. And then even now today, to go in environments where you are told we don't want you to act a certain way or be as emotional as you are, or the church actually telling you, you know, to be quiet, or in some cases even saying we will give our money to their communities, but we don't want them in our congregations.
Mm. So
Mitchell,
you felt excluded. Clyde
Mitchell, I'm really glad you called in. I happened to go to attend irregularly a Baptist church, in which one of the goals is racial reconciliation. And it's Winter Park Baptist Church, and they have a sister church, Macedonia Free Will Baptist. And one of the things that there's not a lot of mixing, but we do trade pastors now and then, and it's a great experience. One of the things we're doing is putting together a cookbook with 15 recipes from the white church. People's pictures are in there, and 15 recipes from the black church, people's pictures are in there. But you can't just have a recipe. You have to have a food story. Because one of the things I recognize is that the food that I grew up eating was in my community, rural North Carolina, was so much like the food that black people ate. And that's one of those commonalities, which is important in lives, in our lives, what we eat and how we eat and what we do at mealtimes. But there is some movement toward racial reconciliation, which I'm so... I'm proud of that it's happening, especially in the South, and so much is going on in the South that it is positive because we're in the middle of a problem. But I agree with you that there's so much intentional and unintentional racism that happens in the name of Christianity, God forbid.
Mitchell, thank you so much for your call. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with author and creative writing professor Clyde Edgerton about why issues of race and diversity are so important to him. We are going to get to some of his creative endeavors in just a moment. But first, let's hear from John from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Rachel and Clive. This may be a little off topic, so I'll be very quick. Just out of curiosity, were you a nail fact at NKP?
Yeah, that's the question was on nail fact at NKP. That means was I a forward air controller in the Vietnam War in Thailand? And I was a nail forward air controller there. I was nail 3-8. How about you? Were you there?
I sure was. What year were you there?
I was there 70-71.
Oh, my goodness. We crossed paths. I was up in the PDJ area as an RF-4 pilot, and we worked some of the stuff down in, with you guys. Anyways,
what year were you there? What year?
70.
70. What, do you know? You remember, well, you and RF-4, we need to get together because we can share a lot of stories.
Hey, John, if you call back after we hang up, our producer, Rachel, can get your contact information, or you can just email me at coastline@whqr.org, and I'll forward it to Clyde.
Okay, the quick question, it does relate to your topic. I'm sure you've watched the Ken Burns series on Vietnam, and I didn't realize half that stuff was going on here. I was a young officer pilot and just was oblivious to what was going on over there or over here. And I wonder what your take is on that series.
I saw the first three, and I thought it was a tribute in a good way to the truth. And I haven't seen the rest. For some reason, I can't remember exactly why I couldn't see the rest. I wanted to, but I'm going to see the rest. And I think it was an unfortunate situation in many ways, and I have my own personal story, which I've written about in Solo, the book Solo, and I'd love to hear your take on it all, too, when we have time.
John, thank you so much for calling in. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with Clyde Edgerton. You can ask your own question. Just a few minutes left during the live Thursday edition. 910-343-1138 is how you get in touch with us, or coastline@whqr.org. Susie from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I wonder if the professor has read Bishop Desmond Tutu's book on truth and reconciliation in South Africa. And if not, I think it's a must read because to me it's almost like somebody going to therapy. And you say that nobody wants to talk about what their experience or how they feel. And I don't think anything is going to happen. It's just going to keep festering until people tell the truth. And that's the same as it is in a therapist's office. If you don't tell the truth, how can you get at what happened?
Susie, give us an example of a truth that needs to be told here. What do you mean specifically?
I would say the suffering. In Tutu's book, people tell the truth and there are no consequences. That was the thing, is that then they're not thrown in jail. They're not, and they all agreed to accept whatever the truth was. But the fact is they all had to speak it. The way that somebody tortured somebody, mm-hmm. This was in South Africa. Mm-hmm. But I think that nobody is telling their story.
I very much appreciate your perspective, and I think you're right about so much. And the talk can happen, and people can talk, and there are ways. There's reasons to be optimistic when people are beginning to talk in certain places. But you've got to have support for that, and you can't have pushback, which there's unfortunately all among us is pushback against this kind of talk because it seemed somehow as tainted.
Susie, thank you so much for that call. We have Doc from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Clyde, you and I grew up, went to the same school, Rebels, Stars and Bars and all of that in Southern and Durham. And we had this similar backgrounds and experiences. And I'd be curious to hear how you what you attribute to yours, and I think mine as well, how we didn't let the fact that we were grew up in a segregated world have a poisonous effect on our sense of relations with the African American community. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Is this Doc Hamm?
Yeah.
Doc, it's great to hear you. I'm talking one of the greatest shag dancers in the world, by the way, people. Anyway, the way
that's
it happens.
Hamm with two M's.
One thing that helped me was to go to Chapel Hill. My preacher preached against Chapel Hill, a sermon one time when I was growing up. The world opened up to me, and I think it could have been any university in many ways. You just start seeing other things and other ways of thinking and other ways to talk and relax and know that other people are human beings, and they're 99.9% just like you are. And that's what made a difference with me, and I'm sure it was similar to you. And by the way, that shag dancing is a great history and how that came from not far from where we are, from a black population. A lot of the great, fun, wonderful, warm stuff is a consequence of interracial relations and trade-offs and exchanges.
Thank you so much for your call, Doc. Appreciate hearing from you. That's a nice segue into your view of fun. You are prolific as an artist. You're a musician. Somebody in an email asks, is Clyde Edgerton still singing? Several decades ago, Clyde was frequently heard singing some much fun tunes he wrote, like Quiche Woman in a Barbecue Town and the Lone Star Rattlesnake Bar. Are you still singing?
Chris Cook and I have a little two-piece band, and we get together at Burnt Creek every once in a while and play some blues. And tonight, there's a function going on at Boogie Nights on Princess Street, which is a benefit for the Friends School, their diversity project, and I'm planning to sing at least one song.
Are you?
And do a short reading with some other people, and I think Rachel's going to be there as the MC.
I will also be there. Yes, it's five writers. John Jeremiah.
6:30 or 7 o'clock, John. And yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
John Jeremiah Sullivan, Wiley Cash, Emily Collin, Dana Sachs, and Clyde Edgerton. Tickets, I think, are $40, but there's FSOW.org, I think, is the website. But yes, so you're going to sing tonight. That's a promise. All right, we should sell out. And that question came from Eunice. How important is fun to your art? Because this is one of the things that I've just noticed. I've encountered you now maybe three times, maybe four. And there is a light behind your eyes. There is, you are a charismatic person. And I think a lot of it is because your imagination is free. There's a certain amount of fun with whatever you do. We've had a very serious conversation today. But you sing and you paint. And
I think fun is kind of the bottom line. And I think I'm very lucky and very fortunate in so many ways and have been all my life for many reasons, the least of which is not that I'm a white male in the South or anywhere. And that has helped me get breaks that other people could not get. And so fun, music is fun for me, art is fun for me, and most of the time writing is fun. And if it's not fun, I tend not to do it. And I'm very lucky to have a job that allows me to have fun. I have mechanic friends who, what they do is fun. And it's fun to hear what's fun to different people.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Clyde Edgerton, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was almost fun.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Cavill. Associate producer is Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 and 98.9 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.